Good evening, everyone. Perfect. We're in for a good night tonight. We've got the Bhajavas dual act on a very interesting topic of matriarchs that matter. All right, to introduce our topic tonight, we're going to do just a short reading. It is 2 Samuel 11 and verses 1 to 5. Without further ado, Sean, over to you. We're looking forward to it.
Well, good evening, brothers, sisters, and young people. It is fantastic to see all of you here. So many smiling faces to come and support me and JB in our talk. And, of course, a big hello to those listening in online. So, tonight, we'll be taking a closer look into Bathsheba's story and her character and what an amazing woman she is. Despite facing many challenges with guidance, she manages to change the course of history. And my hope is that by the tonight, I will have been able to reveal to you some intriguing aspects of her character, the influence she has had in the Bible, and some lessons that we can take away personally from her story. So just a summary of what we're going to cover tonight. Just an overview of Bathsheba's life. Her genealogy, we will cover 2 Samuel 11, of course, 1 Kings 1 and 2, and summarise with some practical lessons for you. So, her life overview. She begins the narrative as the wife of Uriah, a loyal soldier. She becomes a widow after Uriah's death. She then marries King David. She bears Solomon, assists Solomon in securing kingship with Nathan the prophet, and then indirectly causes Adonijah's death. Now, just from this elementary overview of her life, we can tell she's had a very large impact on the political landscape of Israel. Despite having her husband killed, she has managed to assert her son as king, doing so, save from Adonijah's potentially horrific rule over the kingdom. Her genealogy is actually just as interesting as her major life, Bathsheba's grandfather, Ahithophel, was renowned as the wisest counselor in Israel. Her father, Eliam, and later Uriah were both highly respected mighty men, known for their strength and valor. Additionally, her husband is King David, and she has a son, Solomon, who would later become one of the most well-known kings of Israel. So from her genealogy, it's clear that Bathsheba has always been surrounded by powerful and influential people in Israel's society. Bathsheba lives in a city and in a place where just one wrong move can be outcast. Bathsheba not only manages to stay relevant and respected in her prestigious position, by the start of her son's reign, many years later, she is sitting at his right hand. So we started off tonight in 2 Samuel 11, and there we read of David's sin, tragedy, and cover-up. In verse 2, he sees a beautiful woman bathing and inquires about her and lays with her. Now, rather ironically, while Bathsheba in this story is cleaning and purifying herself, David is conceiving a sin in an almost textbook manner. James 1 verse 14 to 15 tells of the lust and temptation and the process it follows, and David regrettably follows this exact pattern. Bathsheba, after trying to purify herself, was forced into adultery, and it's an interesting contrast between these two characters in this chapter. So Bathsheba at this stage in her life has had some relations with someone other than her husband Uriah, and is now, as we see in verse 5, well, we don't see, but in verse 5 in your Bibles, she is with child. So she must have her mind racing. What will Uriah think? What will Israel and her family think? Her nieces, her nephews, everyone's going to know about this tragedy. You can only imagine what's going through her mind. This situation alone is pretty horrific, but unfortunately it only gets worse. Uriah comes home in verse 7, and she doesn't get to see him. She later learns of his death. Now, Bathsheba by this point must be inconsolable. She has had this sin and a child forced upon her and is now suffering the loss of her husband. Worse still, the kingdom knows of David's sin and she is in the spotlight. To reiterate, she is mourning her husband's death and she is now in the spotlight for a nationwide scandal. The situation could not be worse. After grieving for her late husband, she marries David, the murderer of her late husband, and her child, whom she carried for 9 months,
9 months, regrettably dies. Wow. That is one of the most sobering starts to a biblical journey. Her husband, her societal stance, her child, gone. Now, according to the World Health Organization, a single traumatic event can boost the probability of you acquiring severe depression from 30 to 60%. A single traumatic event. Bathsheba has experienced 4 within 9 months. It's hard to even think about how someone's life could become soured so quickly. But despite the trauma, despite the pain, Bathsheba, with great strength, picks herself up. And by the end of her story, as I've said tonight, she is sitting by the right hand of her son Solomon. And even though the Bible doesn't state clearly that she prays and appeals to God to help her with her woes, for me there is absolutely no doubt that without faith in the Lord, she could pass such a trial. Now for David, the consequences are also severe. His self-esteem is lowered thanks to the royal courts and spies, whispering and gossipers. It's likely every man, every mighty man, every advisor, the priests, along with most of the nation, knows of this sin. Worst of all, his relationship with God is at an all-time low, as we can see in 2 Samuel 11, verse 27, which reads, "But the thing David had done displeased the Lord." I wonder if this lowering in self-esteem may have been the reason he couldn't control his children. But nevertheless, in contrast, Bathsheba's parenting is shown to be exemplary. Even before Solomon becomes king, Bathsheba is making sure her son will be able to rule. So now we shift our focus to 1 Kings 1 and away from 2 Kings 11. Is there a chance I can have someone read 1 Kings 1 for me? Just up to verse 9. Is anyone willing to do that? Darcy, fantastic. 1 Kings 1, just up to verse 9.
And it came to pass when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all Solomon's desires which he wanted to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time, as he had appeared to him in Gideon. And the Lord said to him, "I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever."
Is that 2 or 1 Kings?
That's 1. Sorry, mate.
So from verse 6, if that's all right.
Oh, verse 6, okay. "Then he arose and went into the house, and you poured the oil on his head and said to him, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord over Israel. You shall strike down the house of Ahab your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants the prophets.'"
I've used the ESV translation. I'm not sure what version you're using, but that must be pretty far off. Anyway, from what I gathered in 1 Kings 1 and the first 6 verses, we're covering Adonijah's feast. So Adonijah holds a feast to proclaim himself as king. And in the final verse, after inviting many officials, highlighted in red there, we can see, "But he did not invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaiah, or the mighty men, or most importantly, he doesn't invite Solomon, his brother." Now, out of all the people, and Solomon even had brothers from Bathsheba, Solomon is the only son of David not specifically invited. And by not inviting him, Adonijah has shot himself in the foot, so to speak, as he's showing some disdain and dislike for Solomon. Now, moving forward, after his chariots and men parade through the city, word gets out that Adonijah is making himself king. Nathan the prophet, in the same chapter, who was also not invited to Adonijah's feast, now approaches Bathsheba in verse 12. Now, Bathsheba is noted as Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon. It's very interesting that this is reiterated, almost emphasizing her role as a motherly figure. So Nathan then tells her to talk to David, and he tells her to say in verse 13, quote, "Did you not, my lord the king, swear to your servant David, saying, 'Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne.' Why then is Adonijah king?" So after being told to say these things, Bathsheba quickly goes to David
and humbles herself before him. She pleads to David
that without
his intervention, both her and Solomon's lives are at risk if Adonijah becomes king. Now, Nathan hasn't told her to say this, but Bathsheba, in her wisdom, feels the need to appeal to David in a way that will really get his attention. So she highlights in her speech his relationship with the Lord, his relationship with her and his son, and most importantly, that all Israel is watching. Three very distinct and very large points. Now, when David committed his sin with Bathsheba in 2 Samuel 11, these three points, these three aspects of his life were severely impaired. His relationship with the Lord, his relationship with his people and Bathsheba, all very hurt thanks to his sin. But now, with Bathsheba's appeal, he actually has a chance to make things right again. And after she has appealed to David to fulfill his oath made before the Lord, David restores Solomon as the rightful heir, and in the process, correcting some of his own failings, as we can see, including losing control of his children, as seen with Absalom. So Bathsheba and Nathan have saved the future of the kingdom. Solomon has been restored as the rightful king. And with the saving of the future of the kingdom, she has also helped her husband reclaim some of the honour that he lost with his sin. And by Bathsheba's remarkable wisdom, Bathsheba, Solomon, and Israel are spared from Adonijah's reign. So in this story, we've clearly seen her remarkable role as a mother to Solomon, her strength in being willing to confront David, and her wisdom in the words she chooses. But this entire sequence would not have been possible, not at all, without God's divine help. God has used Bathsheba as a vessel to achieve his will, fulfilling David's oath he made to the Lord. By faithfully listening to God's prophet Nathan and sticking up for David's oath sworn to the Lord, we can really see Bathsheba's faith shine. But her story doesn't end here. After David's passing, as recorded in 1 Kings 1, Solomon firmly establishes his throne. Bathsheba, having successfully secured Solomon's rightful place as king of Israel, has demonstrated some great strength, faith, wisdom as a mother. However, there is still one man who remains really unhappy with this situation, Adonijah. Following his failed attempt to claim the throne, it's easy to imagine Adonijah is feeling some anger, jealousy, and possibly some very low self-esteem, especially considering his embarrassing display at his own feast that we have just read about in 1 Kings 1. In the midst of these tumultuous emotions, Adonijah makes a surprising and strategic request. In 1 Kings 2, verse 17, he says, "Please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife." Now, he justifies this request by saying, "You know that the kingdom was mine and that all Israel fully expected me to reign. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord." Now, this interaction naturally leads us to some key questions. Firstly, why didn't Adonijah ask Solomon himself directly? How did Adonijah not anticipate Solomon's reaction? And why does Solomon react so harshly to what seems like a simple request? Most intriguingly, however, why does Bathsheba agree to do Adonijah's bidding? So first, let's explore, why did Adonijah go to Bathsheba? Well, in the following verses in 1 Kings 2, verse 19 to 24, we actually see the answer, though it's not spelled out for us. It reads, "So Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him on behalf of Adonijah, and the king rose to meet her and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a seat brought for his mother, and she sat on his right." This shows some high regard that Solomon holds for Bathsheba. He's showing her respect. He gives her a seat of honour and bows in the presence of the court to his mother. Now, just generally, in Near Eastern culture, so Middle East, the position of the right hand was the place of greatest honour, authority and favour aside from the king. The greatest. To sit at someone's right hand was to be close to them in an influential and commanding type of position. To reiterate my point, another example of someone sitting at a right hand is Jesus Christ. As described in Mark 16, verse 19, he sits at the right hand of God. Her role as a mother and her influence in the court with this respectable position is absolutely evident. She approaches Solomon with humility, acknowledging her position as queen and mother, and makes her request politely, saying, "I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me." Solomon again responds respectfully, inviting her to speak freely in the court, indicating a very high level of respect for her. Solomon's uniquely high respect for his mother is very significant here, and it appears that it's the reason Adonijah won't go to Solomon directly. Adonijah is trying to abuse this respect to get his will. So, we come to Solomon's reaction. Why does Solomon react so harshly? Bathsheba asks for Abishag the Shunammite to be given to Adonijah as his wife in 1 Kings 2, verse 17. And Solomon's response is immediate and stern. He says, "And why do you ask for Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also? For he is my older brother. On his side are Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah." He then swears in verse 23, Adonijah will pay for this with his life, essentially. Now, Adonijah's request clearly carries some ill intent, but it's not until we turn to 2 Samuel 16 that we see the full extent of the evil behind Adonijah's request. Adonijah's brother in 2 Samuel 16, Absalom, was advised by Ahithophel to sleep with David's wives as a way to assert himself as king. Interestingly, in 2 Samuel 16, verse 23, Ahithophel's advice is described as being given as if one consulted the word of God. Very sound advice if you would like to steal a kingdom, to sleep with the king's wives. Ahithophel has accidentally given some fantastic advice to someone trying to steal his great-grandson's throne. For all his wisdom and knowledge, I don't think he could ever have predicted something like this, but it's interesting nonetheless. So, with those 2 points covered, this leads to our essential question tonight. Why does Bathsheba agree to the request of Adonijah? Bathsheba's decision can be understood through her character. Throughout her story just tonight, she has shown herself to be a woman capable of navigating complex political situations very skillfully, as we've seen earlier with her wise approach and wise words with David. The first two theories are some generally accepted theories by biblical scholars, and unfortunately, thanks to the formatting, you can't read them, but I have them on my screen. I'll read them for you. So the first theory is a desire for peace. Bathsheba may think that by giving Abishag to Adonijah, he will be appeased and peace will remain in the kingdom. The second theory is she has a tremendous respect for Solomon, so she must recognize his wisdom and authority and perhaps trusts he will see her request as reasonable or that he will act justly. The final theory I put to you tonight, and what I believe, is considering her wise approach to conversation that we have seen tonight and considering her as a parent, I believe she knew Adonijah would die after she told Solomon this request, and that that death would ensure no other stepsons could trouble Solomon, and Adonijah himself, with his evil intentions, would never claim the throne. So to summarise tonight, we've explored 2 Samuel 11, 1 Kings 1 and 2, delving into Bathsheba's character and the meaning behind her actions. We've seen patience, wisdom, faith, and an amazing journey with some amazing acts. So what are some practical lessons that we can take away from Bathsheba? Three key elements I want you to remember from tonight. Bathsheba's faith is evident in her actions. Like Bathsheba, we should strive to be steadfast, just as she was throughout her long tenure, steadfast in our faith and not afraid to show our faith through our actions, just as Bathsheba wasn't. We should be careful and wise in approaching our situations. Bathsheba's thoughtful words and choices meant a better outcome, and just with thoughtful words and choices, we can lead to better outcomes with our brothers and sisters in our own ecclesia. And finally, Bathsheba's strength and resilience highlights a really important inner strength when facing challenges in our life and pushing on with our life when times get tough. Whether the pressures are external or internal, keeping focused on your faith and looking to the kingdom is what's most important. So by embodying these characteristics we have seen tonight, I hope your journey to the kingdom may be a little easier. Thank you all for your time. I will now pass the mic to James.
I think he's coming back. That's all right. In the meantime, thank you so much, Sean, for your considerations and pushing on for showing strength and resilience when technology fails. Thank you, Darcy, for volunteering and giving us extra reading credits today. We appreciate that. And some amazing things to consider, and what a remarkable woman that we've just considered. That's right, I am aware of what's going on. He will return. Maybe in the meantime, have a little chat to the person next to you. Okay, sorry. We are now ready. Ladies and gentlemen, court is in process. Could you please rise while we welcome Judge Bajabos tonight? Thank you. Please rise.
Bailiff, ladies and gentlemen, please be seated. Of course, this afternoon, I'm just going to remind the jurors of their responsibility. You've been appointed by your peers to make a judgment, guilty or otherwise, on five matters that we have been deliberating with for some time. Various acts of problematic promiscuity. And just as a reminder, the punishment, of course, if found guilty, is death. So we have the death stones. Our first defendant, Tamar, is accused by her father-in-law of fornication, and the evidence that he's brought before us is her heavily laden belly being some 7 months pregnant. It's all fairly obvious. He has demanded that she be burned as punishment. Our second defendant tonight is Rahab. Rahab has been accused, standing before you, of crimes of prostitution. Now, I remind the court that those crimes were committed well before her knowledge of the one true God of Israel, and her character witnesses, two in total, spoke very well of her character, of her faithfulness, how she was told to do certain things and, in fact, let the whole Jericho army on a wild goose chase to ensure their safe escape, and fully obeyed the demands given of her that she was to have people protected in her home and to dangle a red cord out of her brothel window. Third defendant is a lady called Ruth. She's a Moabitess. She was observed by two or even three of the local town's gossips alighting in the dead of night from Beth Salem's most eligible bachelor's home. They are accusing her of getting him drunk and then not only stealing his virtue, but stealing two large bushels of grain. That was a joke, supposed to bring the court to order, but thank you for your laughs. The fourth defendant, if you please, Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. She is appearing before us on charges of flaunting her naked self on the rooftop and then seducing our very king after tempting him inter alia. Final charge, which appears to have been brought by numerous plaintiffs, including the Sanhedrin, scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, and the high priest himself against Mary. It is odd that these charges relate to an event 33 years prior, but they are grave nonetheless. Fornication prior to marriage. Now, jurors, I remind you, these charges are very, very serious, and all defendants face death by stoning or otherwise. Bailiff, you appear to be waving your arms about. Is there a distraction? Ah. Please approach the bench.
Sure.
Yes, Your Highness.
Right.
Just whisper to me in my general ear.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ha ha ha! Well, well, well. So now, dear jurors, a strange turn of events, and I can confirm all charges against Tamar have been dropped. Tamar, you are free to take your bloodstone and leave the court. So now, dear jurors, you must ask yourselves, before you pass judgment, which one of you will cast the first stone against one of these women? I ask you to consider guilt or innocence. So, thanks for coming to class. You can clap now if you wish. Thank you, thank you. All right. No, I like it. And staying on. No, I won't keep it on. Okay, so this is the final in our four-part series looking at my topic, which is what topics, subjects, areas do these five women have in common? So what we'll do first is I'm not going to worry about the recaps. But in the broader topics, we have explored places, we have explored providence, we have explored past, present, and future. Tonight we'll look at people and personal things. The P is an alliteration. You have to talk to Tan about it. So hello, Tan. Hello, Tim. Now, this is like the busy spreadsheet that ties all of these topics together. So last time we looked at promises and oaths, we looked at all of the women are called either righteous or faithful. We spoke about kingship. Now, it's fairly apparent as we're dealing with a royal line that kingship would be a topic that would be in common with all of them. You might recall that we had a look at the idea of being comforted, how all of the women were comforted, and I hope you were able to resolve the trouble with Rahab in the genealogy, because the Rahab we know from Matthew chapter 1 verse 6, I think, looks, her name is different to the Rahab that's in James 2, and we have to reconcile that somehow. They look similar, but they're as different as Ronnie and Johnny. What's in a name? Okay, so to conclude the past, present and future bit, we had to look at problematic promiscuity. And I see that all of the bloodstones are intact and no one has cast them. Tonight, let's... I'm just going to whiz through this because I really want to get to the important tie. So you'll see the way the spreadsheet works. We've got the individual matriarchs up the top, and then on the left-hand side, we've got the various topics which they hold in common. Spies. We will remember from the stories that spies were involved. With Rahab, we had two spies. With Ruth, what the judge highlighted was this was Bethlehem's most eligible bachelor. There would have been all sorts of mothers-in-law spying on him, trying to sort of foist their single daughters onto him. The royal court, Sean highlighted, there were spies everywhere. Same with Mary. So remember, at the Last Supper, Mary is not involved in that. I think one of the reasons was Jesus wanted to keep her safe, as importantly as wanting to speak to his best friends. Spies, evidence? Well, Jesus doesn't say to his disciples, I want you to go to 22b Delora Avenue, Jerusalem South. He says, go and look for a man that's holding a jar of water and just follow him. He didn't want to tell the disciples where they were going. They didn't know where they were going. They were just given a simple instruction. And there were spies in the story of Tamar. Your dad, he's at the intersection. You know, the one that goes to Timnath. Oh, right, thanks. And then she goes and gets changed. They all had older partners. Judah was the father-in-law of Tamar. Ruth married Boaz, who was older to her, it would appear, by what he says. Uriah, I think, was older than Bathsheba. In the story where Nathan is trying to get David to own his problem, he describes Bathsheba as this little cute baby lamb. And I believe Joseph was older than Mary too. I think they're all widows. In fact, Tamar was widowed twice. Ruth was married to Chilion. Bathsheba was married to Uriah. Joseph is not mentioned after the temple episode when Jesus was 12. Rahab, what got her into her profession of prostitution? It was generally financial security to feed yourself or your children. If she was previously married and had no support, that might have been the cause that led her into that vocation. Like a progeny. So, in spite of these women being married, they never had any babies. But with a very brief tryst, Tamar becomes pregnant with twins. Rahab was a prostitute for how many years? Never pregnant, but then has a little bub. 10 years Ruth was married without having a baby, and Bathsheba was possibly married for many years, has no children, but then with David has five. And there's a miracle birth, obviously, with Mary. And a really curious point about the number of children Mary might have had. So we've got Bathsheba has five children, five boys. Her eldest child dies. Mary's eldest child dies, and she has four other boys. If we add Tamar two children, Rahab one, Ruth one, then perhaps the number of children Mary had in total was nine. Four girls, four boys, with her eldest passing away. They're all described as beautiful, physically attractive women. So we go through the pattern of the way that Judah chose his wife, Shua. He was looking around. He picked the best looking one. And the pattern followed for the way that he selected his own son's wife. It was definitely a captain's pick. He saw and he took. He liked what he'd seen. Now, in Boaz's case, poor old Boaz, he can't believe his luck. You know, you could have had the pick of any of the blokes, he says to Ruth. Any one of them, they would have been very happy to marry you. Of Bathsheba, one version describes her as stunningly beautiful. Now, we're not told about Mary's physical qualities, but we are certainly told that she was beautiful on the inside. Now, I haven't mentioned Rahab, but Rahab's quite a particular and a peculiar case. So in the Midrash historical stories, Rahab is I wouldn't call them fables, sort of historical fables, if you like, bit of fiction mixed with fact. Rahab is one of four women who were described as the most beautiful women ever. If we were to take a guess on the other three, their guesses might have included
Eve,
Sarah,
Helen of Troy.
Well, I think they're Israeli women, but as good as Helen of Troy was,
Esther
was in the list, and so was Abigail. In fact, what the Talmud says, Rahab was so beautiful that at the very mention of her name, it would cause inordinate desire. Some say the same about the name James, but I think we should settle down, people. They all have very difficult financial circumstances too. I mean, in the main, they were just really poor. But I want to have a conversation about how we sort of define poverty and widowhood. So in Luke 21, we have the story of, you know, the widow with her two mites. You know, she's got two little tiny bronze coins that if you drop them on the carpet, you wouldn't hear them make a sound. But if you put them in the big temple collection trumpets, they would make a little tinker. Has anyone ever imagined that woman to be anything but extremely old? I'd never had. But most of the women which we're dealing with were widows at a very young age. In particular, Tamar was probably, listen carefully, a mid-teenager when she was first widowed. So, you know, I just thought that was sort of an interesting thing. Poverty. So Tamar has nothing, goes home. Ruth has lost everything, comes back to Bethlehem, an impoverished foreign widow. Bathsheba was living on a soldier's wage, and fairly clearly Mary and Joseph's finances before marriage. It was a struggle for them. Until God intervenes. And then we find Rahab marries a prince, Ruth marries a very eligible bachelor tycoon, Bathsheba marries a king, and in Tamar's case, she eventually enters the home of a wealthy farming land baron. And Mary receives three very expensive post-baby shower presents. So the lesson for us: one day, if we're faithful and righteous, we'll all win Division 1 of a mega draw. No, that's not the lesson, is it? The lesson is God will see us through. Give us neither riches or poverty. It's actually not about our finances, what we have in our wallets. What we're about is treasures in heaven. And in fact, in the case of Tamar, she would have slept in a cave rather than in a palace, I suppose, as long as she had her two boys with her. And no one knows what the next 10 minutes will bring, let alone what tomorrow will bring, so we should never take anything for granted. But if we take a moment to compare our circumstances, our communities, our connectivity, our transport, our healthcare, our family support, government assistance, our overall finances, and then compare them to the five matriarchs, all of them before their life circumstances change, what we learn from their shared experience is that they are incredibly resilient and faithful and very tough chickies. I have a secret. It always gets the blood flowing. You know, I've got a secret. Tell me. Now, Dandenong High School was a famous literary centre of education. Most people know that on the global scale. We had a novel which we had to read in Year 8, which was banned in most good societies, and it was called The Go-Between. The Go-Between. It was, in its day, it was considered absolutely outrageous. Not at Dandy High, it was core. It was our textbook for Year 8. Now, some of us might be familiar with this idea of a go-between. Was your first experience of a go-between similar to mine? Now, my first experience of a go-between was behind the portables when I was in about grade 2. When my little buddy told me that her little buddy liked another little buddy of mine, and if she liked him, would I like her, and then we could all be friends. So I think she, as a go-between, was doing a reasonable job, but she probably had a slightly ulterior motive. I have a secret, my friend likes you. So a go-between. A go-between is a person who takes messages between people who are either unable or unwilling to meet each other. So let's think about the idea of go-betweens and how that relates to the story of our five matriarchs. Tamar's go-between alerted her to Judah's comings and goings. Ruth had Naomi working behind the scenes, matchmaking and setting up the plays. Bathsheba's go-between is mentioned three times in two verses, going from David to Bathsheba and then back again with the news that she was eventually pregnant. Now, Rahab's go-between was quite interesting because it was the king's messages initially and then it was the spies. But the most powerful and compelling example of the go-betweens is in Mary's case, because the go-between her and God was the angel Gabriel. For there is one God and one mediator who can reconcile God and humanity, the man Jesus Christ, our emissary, our advocate, abides in heaven interceding on our behalf. So Jesus is the go-between between us and God. But this concept of a go-between was yet another shared experience that these women had. Right, so that's the summary. That's what this little section looks like. So, yes, you can take a photo if you wish, and we will move on. Did I want to talk about anything else? I don't think I spoke about obedience. Let's just deal with obedience quickly, and then we'll deal with the final element that ties these women together. Now, we haven't dealt with all of them. I think we've had four different nights, and there's another two nights on this topic. Let's talk about obedience. So remember, when the second husband of Tamar is taken by God, there is a third brother that is promised to Tamar. Don't worry, Judah says. You can be married to him when he's of age. In the meantime, I want you to go home. And humiliated and in shame, she goes home and she stayed. And she stayed. And for years, she stayed. She stayed until. Now, Rahab's obedience is quite incredible. Firstly, she told no one of the spies. Secondly, she followed the express commands of the spies to the letter, which was, if you want anyone to survive, we will only be responsible if they are under your roof. And they were. But they then say, you also have to dangle this red cord out of your window, which she did. So that obedience ensured the salvation of herself and her family. Ruth was obedient. So in chapter 2, we read of the story where Boaz says to her, hey, look, stick with me and you'll be safe. You won't need to go anywhere else. She goes home and says that to Naomi. And Naomi says, what'd you do? Oh, I did exactly as I was told. I stayed there. I was protected. So she obeyed because she trusted Boaz. Mary's words are incredible as an act of obedience. May it happen according to your word, she says to an angel that says to her, you're going to have a baby without knowing a man. You're going to have this virgin birth. I'm your servant, she says. May it happen to me according to your word. So that sentence exemplifies her willingness to submit to God's will. Despite the potential social and personal repercussions. Now, I think if we put ourselves in Mary's shoes, having spoken to the angel, we would have been full of fear. We would have been full of doubt. But she did not say no. She obeyed. Wasn't an easy path, but God doesn't always call us for the easy paths or journeys. But he will always be with us along the way. And that's something that these women knew implicitly. So our final little point of discussion for this series. If there is a tie that binds the women, that unites their stories, what colour do you think that would be? If you answered red, I'll accept scarlet, you would be correct. In the story of Tamar, we have what would be one of the more excruciating births, I suppose. I mean, a baby pops its hand out, has a wave, gets a wristband, goes back in, and then the other brother swings around, does a somersault with three twists in the pike position, out he comes, and then he comes out second with his red scarlet cord wrapped around his wrist. We've obviously known from Sunday school that, you know, Rahab dangled out a scarlet cord. It wasn't the rope, by the way, was it? You know, they got down off the rope. This was just a little scarlet cord. Don't know why that was the case, but it appeared to be something that the one of the spies had on them and handed it over. So then that leads us to consider how the scarlet thread ties the remaining three women to their stories with each other. So let's talk about Ruth first. Does anyone know in the Hebrew Bible where the book of Ruth appears? Because it's different to ours. We've got Joshua, Judges, Ruth. Well, in the Hebrew Bible, we have Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Ruth. Song of Solomon, Ruth. Why? Why is it different? Is it just because of the structure? You know, we've got the law, the prophets, the stories. Is it for ceremonial reasons? Because there's a feast and one of them is dedicated to Solomon and the next one's dedicated to Ruth? Like, is it sort of a change in the calendar? Let's just think about this. Proverbs 31, we know that proverb really well. The proverb of the virtuous woman. And that was written by Lemuel, who we believe to be Solomon. Okay, so we've got a few facts. We've got virtuous woman proverb. We've got Solomon's written it, and we've got Ruth later. Let's think about this idea, virtuous, for a moment. That word virtuous is a rare word. Outside of the book of Proverbs, it only occurs in one place. And you'll find that place in Ruth chapter 3, where Boaz says to Ruth, "Everyone knows you're an honourable woman." Now, honourable is a nice word, isn't it? Honourable sounds nice. But actually, the root of it means to be a warrior. To be so courageous and so brave and so resilient, you're a warrior. Solomon writes, "Who will find a courageous woman?" It's believed that Solomon's proverb on the virtuous woman was directed towards Ruth, and that's why the book of Ruth appears after the book of Proverbs in the Jewish Bible and not before. Is that it? Not quite. This woman is so great. She is described as a scarlet-coloured gem. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. Not sapphires, not emeralds, not gold, not even diamonds, but scarlet-coloured rubies. I am doing my best here to tie this story together, but there's one other element. There's one other element. This woman used to handmake clothes amongst a whole group of other stuff. What colour were the clothes? And verse 21 tells us, take a guess. No one wants to say scarlet, but that's the answer. All of her children are dressed in scarlet. Who else was dressed in scarlet? Well, we're told in Matthew 27, just before Jesus is about to be crucified, verse 28, I think, from memory, that he was adorned with a scarlet-coloured robe. Mary sees her son literally with scarlet threads. I have done my best now to bring your attention to the fact that this idea of a scarlet thread unites these four women. What about Bathsheba? So Bathsheba is a little trickier to bring into this story. It involves a 10-point explanation. That is way too much for you to stay on track with me, so I'm merely going to say this. When Bathsheba was bathing the first time, she was having a bath. When she was bathing the second time, immediately after her sex with David, she purifies herself. We're not told how. The law tells us, though, that when a husband and wife have sex, they are supposed to have a bath. Ah, hang on. James, it was her cycle. You know, she was having a period, so did she bathe. There is no evidence of that at all. There are three words for bathing. None of them correlate to the words under the law that deal with her cycle. Furthermore, if you look carefully in Leviticus chapter 15, where the laws relating to that purification process are, it doesn't actually say that the woman had to bathe. The only prescription for her purification was the length of time. To be purified properly, we think about the lamb that was slain from the foundation of the earth. He required his blood to be shed. How were the children of Israel saved? A lamb had to die. Hyssop was put onto the into the blood of that animal and put on the lintels. So that became a forefigure of Jesus saving us. If you look carefully about priests being purified, you'll find that they use hyssop, wool and blood. I think it was an impossible task for Bathsheba to purify herself under the law, because the only consequence of purification under the law for what she and David did were those stones. She could have a bath, but she couldn't wash away what happened. The only way that would have been possible was with wool and blood.